Let's go ahead and get started. We're going to continue the series we began last week on gender identity, I guess we can call it that. God's creation of man and as male and female, and the implications for how we ought to live then. I wanted to start with just a little review of what we did last time. Both last time and this time are somewhat introduction, big picture. Kind of the main point in these first two lessons is that God made humanity, man. He made them male and female as men and women, and to be different, that the distinction is good, and that we should live according to this design, and that to deny or undermine this distinction is both destructive and wrong. It's an expression of the folly of sinful autonomy. So kind of want to get the big picture, and then we're going to look more closely next week, I think, at Genesis 1 and 2, and then like how to distinguish masculinity and femininity from Scripture, and then the implications for that for family, church, and culture. So that's kind of where we're going. But reviewing last time, we started with Genesis 1 and the creation accounts as a whole and how God takes the earth that he creates with the word, his powerful word, and he made it formless and void, and he gives it form by separating it, distinguishing things, shaping things for their tasks, making them good, that is made in wisdom, fit for its place and for its purpose. And one of the last separations that he does, not only day and night and water from water and water from land, kinds from kinds, but also male and female, Adam and Eve. Now, Satan seeks to destroy the order that God has made, not only male and female, but that's part of the order that he seeks to undermine. He's a rebel against God and hates what is good. He is a murderer from the beginning, from our beginning at least. And we know that he was created by God and created very good, but rebelled. Now, thus, paganism has traditionally exalted androgyny, has sought to confuse this order, not worshiping the Creator, but believing in more that everything is ultimately one kind of thing, and has sought to blend those things together. I sometimes had to practically distinguish men and women to survive, but in its religious ritual among the rich and powerful, that was generally exalted. It still is. The denial of the doctrine of creation leads to a revolt against order and distinctions. So today, with an evolutionary perspective, many believe that each person must define and make themselves, and that tradition, the created order, authority, whether that's divine or human, are seen as baseless impositions of power, dehumanizing assaults on the freedom of the individual. And so any biblical teaching is viewed with suspicion, that this is an attempt to maintain power rather than being objective truth that is telling us about the design that is purposefully put into creation. So sexuality, therefore, is a great area of conflict. Theonomy or autonomy, is man going to be his own law, or is there a greater law and design that we should fit in with? Are these distinctions arbitrary, custom-made, therefore, or is there a design? We began looking last time at Deuteronomy 22:5 as kind of a case study in distinctions, and how gender confusion is described as an abomination to God. It is offensive to him. It is a distortion of his creation against the light of nature, is the way that our reformers would have put it, against God's revelation in nature itself. Now, that verse, well, let's go ahead and read it, because we'll spend more time on it today. Deuteronomy 22, verse 5. Again, as a case law, it's using a particular case to express a principle. It says, "A woman shall not wear a man's garment, nor shall a man put on a woman's cloak. For whoever does these things is an abomination to the Lord your God." Now, this verse would not make sense if your identity as a man or a woman, if your gender, depended on your personal choice. Because the clothing is your personal choice, how you choose to present yourself and identify yourself. For a man to visibly identify as a woman by the way he dresses is forbidden because what results is not a woman, but a man presenting himself as one. So we're created as male and female, identities that are ingrained into our bodies, which God also made, and we are called to embrace this identity and to live it out accordingly. So again, my main point here in this talk and last talk is that God created these distinctions. We ought to live them out rather than rebel against them. And one thing that Deuteronomy 22:5 teaches us is that this distinction should be incorporated into our clothing. And so I want to start with that, not because clothing is the most important thing, but it's a clear way of getting at the whole distinction and the way we should identify. It's a visible way we affirm this distinction. Clothing is significant because it communicates something about us to other people. Now, some people are more purposeful about the way they communicate. Some people don't think about it much, but regardless, it's like some people think about their words before they talk more, but they're still going to communicate something even if you haven't thought it through. The clothing is symbolic, is a symbol, is communicating something, and how we choose to present ourselves to others. You probably didn't have to dress the way you did. It's somewhat of a personal choice. Children might not have as much of a choice about it, but it is a chosen identity. Some of the symbols that identify us as masculine or feminine are rooted in the created order and don't change from culture to culture. For example, beards are not feminine. That's just kind of something rooted in nature. Does every man have to wear a beard? Well, maybe not, but it's intrinsically masculine and not feminine. It is intrinsically not feminine. It is something built into the created order. Some symbols, though, may be culturally relative, that might change from culture to culture. Things that might be masculine in one culture, but maybe not so in another culture. Of course, the classic example is kilts in Scotland, where in other cultures that would look feminine, but in Scotland it's definitely not. It's actually a military outfit, and it is very masculine. It's actually different than the skirts that the women wear. So that would be one example of how this can be specific to how is it understood in your culture. Now, distinctive clothing, of which Deuteronomy 22:5 speaks, is usually partially based on creational differences and partially based on connections that are culturally relative. For example, they're partially based on things like body shape that is built into the created order, and your clothing has to account for that. So there's some things that are just going to be the same. Other things that might be culturally relative, such as pink and blue baby colors. That has been, I think, in the last 100 years. And it's more true for babies, and it gets a little less the case as you grow up. Girls can wear blue, and that's, not an odd thing. But especially for babies, if you have a gender reveal party, we have a culturally identified colors that is going to help you. But that's kind of a recent thing, a culturally relative thing. Even skirts being feminine, something that's maybe a little more deeply ingrained, but skirts not being masculine, but again, somewhat culturally relative because it used to be that no one wore pants, and pants were invented, especially when people rode horses more, and usually it was the men riding horses because it was an instrument of war, not a fun hobby, and so it became a masculine attire. But just because something is culturally relative, and this is where I think it's an important point, because usually what happens is it's a social construct, it's culturally relative, therefore it's arbitrary, therefore I must rebel against it to have authentic meaning in life. But just because it's culturally relative doesn't mean that we get to ignore it. It still has meaning. And in fact, it's really helpful to have tradition, to have these things defined, understood in common by our culture. It really helps us to affirm these gender distinctions. Language, for example, is culturally relative, but that doesn't give you free rein how to use it. The English word woman only means woman because that's how our culture understands it. That's how people use it to refer to women. Is there anything intrinsic about those syllables or those letters that is feminine? I don't think so. Yeah, but is there meaning to it? Yes. Do you have the right to use it to mean man? No. That would be a violation of what the word actually means. Another example, not having to do with gender distinctions, but if someone says to show up to an event business casual, that means something, right? Now, that's going to be defined by your culture. What is business casual? You might look it up on Google. What is business casual? But if you show up wearing a tuxedo, because that's what business casual means to me, that defeats the whole purpose of having the term and setting it up, and you're not going to show up in proper decorum for that event. It's relative but meaningful and useful for proper decorum. So tradition is good. It's helpful. Culturally relative symbols with a long history, like words, are less flexible. Symbols that are of recent creation are more flexible. If I create one today, like let's have all men wear bands around their heads and women not, like it would take a while for it to become ingrained and catch on and it'd be more permanent. So not all symbols are created equal. And finally, symbols often work together to form one picture. So it's on the one hand easy to be legalistic, like you have one particular thing that, try to think of an example, but like to focus on it and either say, well, if you're wearing it, like let's just pick beards. You have to wear a beard if you're a man. Well, it's like, well, you can look masculine if you're emphasizing it in other ways. It might help to wear a beard, but that's not the only way necessarily. On the other hand, you could say, well, therefore, if you don't have to wear a beard to be a man, then there's nothing masculine about wearing it. Like, if you boil it down to one individual thing instead of looking at the whole picture, you can either be legalistic or just throw everything out like it doesn't mean anything. So you have to look at how is this person presenting themselves as a whole. And people who do it really purposefully, transgender people really show you the meaning of symbols, that they actually do mean things and are purposefully trying to violate them. All right, any comments or questions before I go further? All right, so one more particular example of how this might work out is a general natural principle is that women's clothing, for example, tends to be softer, more delicate, more embellished. Now, relative to men's clothing. For example, more tends to be more flowery, more flowing, more frilly. It's fitting, for example, for women to wear more jewelry than men. It's more showy. And I think this fits with how Scripture describes women as the glory of man, as also the weaker vessel. Now, weaker vessel doesn't mean the worse vessel. A porcelain vase is weaker than a hammer, but does that mean it's worse? Well, it depends what you're trying to do. It's better for holding flowers, and it's better for all sorts of things. But the trend in clothing here matches the way women are made. A smoother face, a longer hair. So the clothing is drawing out a distinction which is there naturally. Now, this can be distorted by sin, as nature can be. To be ostentatious, to be vain about external appearance, is a more characteristically feminine sin. That's something that when the apostles address it, they are usually specifying women when they address that sin, or that fault. And it's a distortion of that natural trait. So we can think of 1 Timothy 2, 9 through 10, 1 Peter 3, 3 through 4. Can men sin in this way? Can men sin in being ostentatious and showy and vain about their external appearance? Yes, they can. But in that case, not only are they being ostentatious and vain, but they're also being effeminate. They're also being contrary to nature. It's not a distortion so much of their natural place. Is that you can agree with part of it and not part of it? That's one attempt of mine, though, to show how these natural distinctions that God has made expresses it then in the clothing that we wear and how we present ourselves. Now, distinctive clothing is based on traits that are more than skin deep. Masculinity, femininity, they go deeper than the symbols. I'm beginning with appearance because it's on the surface. It's easy to think about in some ways. We think about it every day. It addresses the issue of how you self-identify with your identity that God gives you. But if a man ought to present himself as a man, how much more should he act like a man? If a woman ought to present herself as a woman, how much more should she seek to act according to that nature in other ways? A man who wears manly clothing but then fails to provide for his household because he's lazy or proves to be a coward in battle, he is not manly, even though he might try to appear so. A woman who dresses in a feminine manner but is disrespectful and harsh is not feminine, despite her appearance. You can't just like, I'm going to change things and put some clothing over it, but my attitude's not going to change, and it's not going to work. While men and women were both created in the image of God, they're created with differently with different bodies, different abilities, different responsibilities. And that's where we're going to get to more as we go further into this study. Now, the desire to define oneself apart from God's created order is not new. People have lived with this struggle in other ages as well, and especially the early church in the days of the Roman Empire. You know how I mentioned paganism tended to like to blur these distinctions? Well, the early church had to draw a very strong line between the practice of Christians and that of a sexually perverted Greco-Roman society. One guy who's very interesting to read is Clement of Alexandria. He was an early church father from about the 2nd century or so, early 3rd century. He has a book called The Instructor, I think is what it's called. It's very interesting. Some of it's a little off the wall, but some of it is very interesting to know what is it like to live the Christian life, especially in the early church context. What were the battles they were facing? And this was a big one. And he launches out at it, strongly condemns not only sexual sins, but also effeminate men who sought to appear smooth and feminine, plucking out their beards and wearing jewelry and soft clothing. He would say, luxury has deranged all things. It has disgraced man. Men play the part of women and women that of men, contrary to nature. Oh, miserable spectacle, horrible conduct. Now, here's an example of his writing, and you can take it for what it's worth. But to show how early church father here was addressing the issue, he said, but for one who is a man to comb himself and shave himself with a razor for the sake of fine effect, to arrange his hair at the looking glass, to shave his cheeks, pluck hairs out of them and smooth them, how womanly. And in truth, until you saw them naked, you would suppose them to be women. For God wished women to be smooth and rejoice in their locks alone growing spontaneously as a horse in his mane. But he has adorned man like the lions with a beard and endowed him as an attribute of manhood with shaggy breasts, a sign this of strength and rule. In this God deemed it right that he should excel and dispersed hair over man's whole body. Whatever smoothness and softness was in him, he abstracted from his side when he formed the woman Eve. Physically receptive, his partner in parentage, his help in household management, while he, for he had parted with all smoothness, remained a man and showed himself a man. Rather, we ought to not call such as these men, but lewd wretches and effeminate, whose voices are feeble, whose clothes are womanish, both in feel and dye, and such creatures are manifestly shown to be what they are from their external appearance, their clothes, shoes, form, walk, cut of the hair, look.
Amen.
So he did not hold back, and you could read more, and it's online, but Clement of Alexandria. And taking his culture to task on that issue and trying to separate Christians from the world around them.
I don't remember what the source was. I remember reading earlier that actually the Greeks held high a male ideal of the smooth skin and no chest hair and all those other sort of things. Mm-hmm. So you could even argue that the origin of a hairless male originates from the pagan Greek culture. Mm. I mean, I'm sure there are other cultures that help with that too, but within the Western tradition.
Uh-huh. Yeah, Clement of Alexandria, it was in Egypt, which of course was very Hellenistic at that time, Greek, that is. And, he's dealing with a culture which definitely was very luxurious in many respects. He talks about the baths and other stuff going on at the time. And he actually points to the barbarians, the Arabs and the barbarians in Germany. It's like, look how rugged they are, and they'll just go on their horse and live off their horse and drink the blood of the horse. Now, you don't drink blood. That's horrible. But it's really admirable in other respects. Like I said, very interesting. But, you know, example that this is not a new battle. Clement as well noted another thing. He recognized the connection between this more general effeminacy and this distortion of sexual differences and sexual perversion, that often they went along with each other. This kind of lack of control, this softness, this self-indulgence played also into sexual immorality, particularly homosexuality. It is, as we look at Romans 1, when it talks about this sin, it talks about how men leave the natural use of the woman, that men and women are designed for each other. It's, in other words, a feminine thing to have sexual relations with a man. It's an effeminate thing for a man to be homosexual. It is not only sex outside of marriage, but it is also a violation of these gender distinctions, men acting as women and women acting as men. And so it is more than one sin on top of each other, one of the things that made it an abomination. So men who seek sexual intimacy with men are not only committing sexual immorality, but they're also violating the principle of Deuteronomy 22:5, acting as a woman. So those sexual perversions, which people talk about today, certainly part of our issue today, is part of a larger trend as well, where we leave the place that God has designed us for and abuse the good gifts that God has given us and seek to go our own way. In our age, the church continues to live among people who seek to blur what God has made distinct, to seek to rebel against God's created order and assert their autonomy. Not only do individuals practice sin, people have practiced sin since Adam and Eve, but these ideas are taught and affirmed in schools, in media, in entertainment, in politics. That's kind of new, at least in the last century or so, that they would actually be upheld as the right ethic to seek this type of autonomy. Egalitarianism, transgenderism, homosexuality, just general autonomy, do whatever you want to do, as long as you're not harming people too much. That's kind of the one limit they'll put. As long as it's consensual, then it's good. And then there's conflict when they're trying to enforce that ethic, when people that don't want any ethic on top of it. But that's probably a discussion for another day.
Mm-hmm. And that was not looked down upon when you said that. Today, it was just, say that sort of thing. But we're talking 50 years, not 100.
Right, right. Yeah, for these things to be exalted as good and it being wrong to condemn them is more like the last 20, 30 years, maybe.
Going back a little further, there's you're probably familiar with The Bride Goes West.
I've seen the title. Yeah, I don't think I've read the book.
It was written in the late 1800s by a woman and her, but she was going out in Montana, And it's interesting you mentioned about riding horses, but she recalls, I think, a pair of young women who were visiting the area. And one of them wore trousers in order to ride horses, where she and this other young woman, and she recognized that the general habit was for women to ride side saddle. That was considered the feminine way to ride side saddle. But she mentioned that the young woman who was insisting on wearing trousers to wear horses, the young men didn't want to have any, were kind of avoiding her.
Mm.
Just because that's, you know, where we came from only, you know, 100 years ago, 150 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, so we're about at time. Just kind of, yeah.
It's just many that firm handshake is almost lost in our society.
Yeah.
When I did the graduation ceremonies of the homeschool, that's what I would practice. Your father takes
There's thinking about that, it's interesting we would think that it leads to the feminization of society, because it is going both ways, you know, but I think maybe because men have traditionally been most visible, that's the most visible manifestations that you've seen it. And on top of it, it also complicates, because a lot of those things are just passed down by custom and habit from father to son, you know, and once you lose in one generation, a lot of people grow up and like, don't know better. Like, is that the way men is supposed to act? Yeah.
But just to make a confession, I would never shake your hand the same way I shake your husband's hand.
Yes, yes. All right. Well, let's pick up with this next week and get into maybe a little more positive. You know, what do we do about it? What's a biblical foundation? And look at, so I'm not remembering better my outline. Probably Genesis 2 next week. And then we're going to go to 1 Thessalonians and just in describing how masculinity and femininity work out. But we'll pick up from there. Let's get ready for worship.